This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories that they've been covering on their award-winning website. And what a week for the banks. Among the winners, Barclays, Lloyds and fraud investigators. Among the big losers, HSBC, RBS and the taxpayer.
It's the increase in mis-selling and conduct costs to rise nearly $6 billion for last year. That's almost doubling it. It just continues the bank that leaks money from every pore.
It is now the time for the challenger banks to step up and step in.
I think it really is, because people are very jaded with the financial system. People are very jaded with the big banks. And this is a great time for challenger brands entering the market, doing something a bit different.
Well, one has in the savings space. Atom Bank is now topping each Best Buy fixed rate table. But why? And talking of savings, as a growing divide develops across the UK, can the wealthy ever understand what it's like to be in a position where you've nothing to put aside?
Or become considerably richer than you through honest hard work. You get what you pay for and you earn what you're worth.
Simon asks, are you on the right side of the savings divide? Also today, the team will tell you everything you need to know about stamp duty on buy-to-let and second homes. The British car industry is booming, but not here. It's not football, so why do we prefer foreign imports over homegrown talent? And Lee, the scam man, coin man, Boyce is in, so naturally we get the latest on both of these. But we are asking today, well, actually, I'm going to change my mind. We were going to be talking about savings, but as you have a poll on your website, I'll ask you about that shortly. I've changed my mind talking about football there. I'm going to ask today, should Claudio Ranieri have got the boot 9 months after Leicester City's historic Premier League win? Has football lost its soul? Is it just as we thought, first and foremost, a business? Do you notice I got some money issues in there? Lee, your thoughts very briefly.
I don't think he should have been sacked. If you'd asked a Leicester fan at the start of last season that you could win the league next year, but the caveat is you might be facing relegation the next season, I think they would have bitten your hand off, wouldn't you? I mean, I think it's a bit of a travesty, really. I read that it was because the players sort of started to moan about him. 2-1 away to Sevilla, who are Euro Cup experts, is no bad result. And I would have at least liked to have seen him have the home leg. They could still squeeze through. And if they went through, then, you know...
But 1 point, one place above the drop zone. Simon, has football lost its soul?
Football lost its soul a long time ago. To be
but
perfectly honest.
Back. Leicester City brought it back.
Oh, they brought it back. It was an anomaly. It was an outlier. It returned some of the soul to football. But I, speaking as a Watford fan, football lost its soul a long time ago. I support a club that swaps its managers like nobody's business, packs the team full of, you know, foreign players, no connection to the club. Yeah, we're doing great. We're in the Premier League and all that. But there is no soul there anymore. It's no wonder people complain about it. And no, I don't think Ranieri should have been sacked. So I understand why they sacked him, because basically they think that it would be catastrophic for the club for them to be relegated. And they've decided to take action now because this is a last ditch roll of the dice. You know, if we do this, we might stay up. But at the end of the day, he gave them that fairy tale. He got them promotion. And I imagine they thought very, very long and hard about this. And it was a very tough decision for them. But I still think they made the wrong decision. Because if they stay up, it'll be credited to them having got rid of Ranieri. But Ranieri could have kept them up anyway. And if they go down, it'll get blamed on Ranieri. But actually, I think that this might be quite good for Claudio Ranieri. Because Claudio Ranieri will always be remembered as the man who won them the title and the man who they then sacked the next season.
Before he could take them down again.
No, but they won't be remembered for, he won't be remembered for taking them down. Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. It won't be a blot on his copybook. So, you know, Claudio, well done. Thanks for the memories.
Well done.
You know,
for all of us, even non-Leicester City fans, it was an amazing season. Lee, you wanted one final comment.
I was going to say, the one other fairy tale worth mentioning has been Lincoln City. I mean, getting through to the quarterfinals, it's been overshadowed a little bit with this Sutton United
Highgate
rubbish. But, you know, fair play to them. You know, those guys are mostly part-time players. They're top of the conference. and they're going to go and play Arsenal away. And I tell you what, I bet they give them a good game.
So the dream carries on, Lee. Positivity.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost here with the team from This Is Money for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. We'll put the football aside. Editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, they're here with me to take a look at the stories they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And this is the week the banks let us know just how well they've been doing over the last year. And it was, well, rather a mixed bag. Good news, as I mentioned, for the likes of Barclays, Lloyds and Metro Bank, but it was rubbish for HSBC. They kicked the reporting season off with a whopping 62% drop in profits. That's on top of 37 probes and lawsuits over a litany of bad behaviour, a fresh investigation by the FCA into their money laundering controls, and a pay cut for their boss, down from 7.4 million in 2015 to just 5.7 million last year. How will he cope?
Annual profits slumped owing to what they call a year of unexpected economic and political events. And their warning of risks in 2017 going forward, again, related to the global economy and the global political situation. It was this dreaded sort of volatile financial market conditions in HSBC's statement, which gets quite a lot of analyst anger, really. This sort of way of saying, you know, it wasn't us, Gov, it's the market, it's not us. It feels a little bit finger-pointing for a company which fundamentally and basically is not growing its revenues across major parts of its business. That is the major problem here. The bank should be growing, and it's not. And that's why people are most disappointed. It feels a bit of a flat excuse, really, for a bank which ultimately has disappointed across the board on this.
Well, company's commentator Ed Thomas then. Well, thank goodness for 72% taxpayer-owned RBS taking the heat from our HSBC. Will it ever turn a profit? 9 years after being bailed out, it reported a loss of nearly $7 billion. It's being blamed on restructuring costs and penalties in the US for mis-selling products. Chris Beauchamp is senior market analyst at IG.
I think it's the increase in mis-selling and conduct costs. You saw those to rise nearly $6 billion for last year. That's almost doubling it from the previous year. We were told that we'd see the bulk of the mis-selling cases being settled last year, and maybe that will now push into 2017 as well. And restructuring costs rising to $2 billion. So it just continues the bank that leaks money from every pore.
It's okay, though. Staff got £340 million in bonuses. No such problems for Lloyds, also given a government handout, kicking the boot into the others by posting its best results for a decade, profits doubling to $4.2 billion.
It's amazing, isn't it? 24 hours ago, everyone was bemoaning the UK listed banking sector with HSBC's pretty poor profitability. Lloyds did everything right. Not only did they beat people's expectations, but they talked about a higher dividend, even a little special dividend by the end of the year. They're controlling costs. You're seeing lending going up. They're very excited about their acquisition of a credit card business. They think that's going to really drive their business forward. Yes, they still had some horrible conduct and litigation and other sort of special one-off costs to bear. But overall, profitability moving in the right direction. And after a pretty shabby period, particularly after the Brexit referendum vote for banks, Lloyd's shares are bouncing back sharply up and moving back towards that 70 pence level.
Well, Chris Bailey, founder of Financial Orbit, speaking there. PBI compensation payments seem to be trailing off. We also got figures out from a host of other banks. But Simon, I'm going to come to you. Now, different issues at different banks. And before we go into each one, not each one, there's quite a few of them, but the main ones. Is it possible to give a holistic overview about the state of the sector? And also, why should we care about these figures being out this week?
Why should we care about the figures on our banks? Well, because our banks are essential to the health of the economy, and a healthy economy needs healthy banks. And because we have a sickly economy that was hobbled by the banks. And also, we saw the vast greed and avarice and deep self-interest and misplaced self-belief from the banks before the financial crisis brought them crashing back down to earth and landed all of us with a colossal bill. Mm-hmm. That's why we should care about what happens to the banks. In terms of a holistic overview, I think what you need to look at is more a sort of a line, and then you can place the banks on that line as to how well they're doing and how healthy they look.
Okay.
And near the bottom of that line, the unhealthy bit of that line, is a certain RBS. And if you're looking at the UK banks, probably up near the top of that line now, is Lloyds. It's a tale of two bailouts, really.
It really is. But is it possible at all, if you take out what they're saying is a lot of legacy issues, restructuring issues, I know. But if you take those issues and you just look at the core of the bank, if you look at the industry, have lessons been learned? Has regulation been put in that is successful?
To be perfectly honest, if you took out all of the things that I waste money on every month and all of the money that I spend on stuff, I'd be absolutely loaded.
That's true.
I mean, like, you know, it's crazy, isn't it? You know, we talk about, well, if you took out all of this stuff and you took out all of that stuff. And sometimes, okay, you do have exceptional costs for a company, mm-hmm. okay? Now, you see this all the time. When you look at a company's earnings, you've got the company's actual earnings, their actual, you know, profits, and then you've got what they deliver as their underlying figures. Now, companies generally tend to prefer to use their underlying figures because their underlying figures, they strip out these exceptional items. However, you have some companies that deliver exceptional items year in, yeah. year out. And at what point do you say, if you're losing, you know, a couple of billion this year, a couple of billion the next year, a couple of billion the year after, a couple of billion the year after, that those things are no longer exceptional? And I think that perhaps if you were going to be sat in a classroom studying this kind of thing, someone might dare to hold up RBS as an example of where these things are no longer exceptional. Mm-hmm. In fact, they are just the norm. And so you should just look at the numbers. And the numbers, you know, these legacy costs. Friday's figures take into account £10 billion in legacy costs, £5.9 billion on conduct charges, and a £2.1 billion restructuring hit. And it's also set aside another £3.1 billion ahead of an expected fine from US authorities linked to the sale of mortgage-backed securities, which was included in the bank's results. I mean, it's like Lloyd's, you know, with the PPI money. That's mm-hmm. not an exceptional cost because it keeps having to set aside this PPI money every single year. Fortunately, this time round, it didn't set aside any, it didn't get as big a hit from PPI as it has done at other times. But can you believe it's not going to get a hit again? It is a bit farcical, to be honest, the bank results. But if you take these two banks, RBS looks just like we should have just split it up. At the point when we bailed it out, they're two very different banks, very different problems. RBS should have been broken up. Lloyd's has been nursed back to health, and maybe that is a success story.
OK, so relegation for RBS, promotion for Lloyd's there. I mean, RBS bailed out by the taxpayer during the financial crisis, reporting total losses of £58 billion. Is it time, like I said, to relegate it, to get rid of the government stake in it, even though you're not going to get a huge amount for it? Just time to just shake it off. Break it down.
It's a hard question to answer because, you know, if they sell their stake now, you know, shares are running at about half the price that they were when they bailed them out in the financial crisis.
So but how can you guarantee they can turn this around? They're saying job cuts, saying restructuring. What's going to be left?
I know, George, you're telling me, and it's been farcical the way RBS has handled, for instance, the Williams and Glynn situation. So, they've been ordered by the European Commission in the financial crisis in terms of the bailout, that they've got to spin off this bank, this Williams and Glynn bank. Fast forward almost 10 years later, and the bank's made a right pig's ear of it. I mean, they've spent billions of pounds separating this Williams and Glynn part of the business. Last week, they turn around and say, actually, do you know what? No, maybe we won't separate. We've got this alternative plan, which is involving small businesses. Small businesses and RBS, notoriously in the last few years, have come to light with some certain documents that have come out. I'm not sure if it's really that great a plan. I had a look on the website, Georgie. I had a look on the RBS website earlier in the week. It's still advertising jobs for Williams and Glynn and the spin-off. So I can't quite get my head around what's going on. And go back to your question, should the government offload it?
Yeah.
Well, share prices in it may continue to fall. So,
exactly.
I mean, it's almost like, where is the point where, is it ever going to reach that five? I think it's 502p a share it was bought for. Is it ever going to get towards those dizzy heights ever again? And I'm not sure.
I do want to ask you about, because we could go on about this for, well, the whole show, but HSBC as well, blaming economic and political conditions. But then when you look at the other banks, you think, well, did it not affect them quite as much?
Yeah,
what is it about HSBC? And let's be clear. I mean, even HSBC posted profits of £5.7 billion. Is that right?
It's a bit more of a global bank, you know, and it's saying that its sort of one-off costs that it's had in its results include getting rid of, like, its Brazilian arm and things like that. So it's looking to, I think, some of the sort of countries that are in, it's trying to reduce its risk. And I think at the moment where it's trying to reduce that risk, it's starting to hit, you know, the costs of actually doing that are pretty expensive. And, you know, it's turning around and saying that that's what's going on. You know, how's it performing in the UK? Well, I look at figures and I see current account customers switching figures. They're constantly losing customers. At the same time, some other businesses that it has in the UK are doing pretty well. You know, First Direct is a very popular bank and a lot of people are going there. So, you know, the future of HSBC, I would suggest, looks a little bit healthier than RBS.
Okay. Simon, your view on that?
I think that if we'd have split RBS, it just got the NatWest side of RBS out of RBS and then put all of the retail side of RBS into NatWest and just had that as a separate bank, that would have probably been much better for the economy in terms of lending money to small businesses and savers over the past however many years it's been that we've owned the 70% stake in RBS. But just to give you a little insight into the world of RBS's banking, and I don't want to be overly mean to RBS and its retail banking arm here, because, you know, it has tried to do the right things over recent years.
Fair enough.
I've looked at its website. Time is running out to make the most of your 2016-2017 ISA allowance of up to £15,240, RBS tells me in a large banner. It has a clock counting down how long I have left. I have 40 days, 10 hours and 39 minutes to act. Even I may be able to act within that short period of time. I have... That's slightly less time than Jesus spent in the wilderness. So I should be okay as long as nobody makes me post something and then I am done. I've then clicked through to see what I can get if I manage to get my acting gear in the next 40 days.
Okay.
Instant access, tax-free savings, instant access ISA. You can transfer into this, guys, so this is a good one.
Okay.
Balance, £1 to £24,999. Yeah, that's my bracket. AER, tax-free, per annum, variable.
We're running down on time here, Simon. I don't know how much of the days we've got left.
Yeah, but this is exciting.
All right, sorry,
40 days.
0.05%.
You are kidding me.
I mean, guys, if you're offering people 0.05%, don't do all the Hollywood stuff. Leave it. Just like hide it somewhere. Hide it somewhere where no one will ever find it. Oh. Don't tell people that they've only got 40 days, 10 hours and 40 minutes to act. Hasn't that just gone up?
Yeah,
wasn't it 40 days, 10 hours and 39 minutes?
It's probably because you just said it there. So many people are listening and thinking, oh, quick, let's get involved. Anyway, we will be talking about some cheer for put upon British savers from a challenger bank shortly. But I do want to talk to you, talking about disappointment, Simon. Anyone on a BA flight of late will testify, I imagine, to some disappointment. However, we got some figures out. It's not just the banks who are reporting at the moment. The owner of British Airways seeing an annual profit, operating profit, rise 8.6%. That's despite taking a hit from the collapse in the value of the pound. Now, International Airlines Group made £2.1 billion in the year to December. The firm's chief exec, Willie Walsh, says it was a good performance in a challenging environment.
You've got to look at the facts. British Airways is a competitive airline. It offers great service at competitive prices. If it didn't, we wouldn't be growing our passenger numbers. We wouldn't be able to improve our profitability.
Competitive being the operative word, perhaps, Simon.
Yes, because I think we thought we should mention this one, because we mentioned it when it happened. And the big thing with BA this year was that it has removed your free drink and your free food on its short-haul flights. And BA said it was doing this, I believe it said it was doing this in somehow in response to customer demand.
Yeah,
customer
we don't
demand
want free
being,
drinks. Yeah.
You know, we asked customers what they wanted. Would you like a free drink? No, we'd love to pay for it. I heard Willie Walsh on the radio this morning defending it, because obviously this was the question that was being asked of him, the most important question. Mm. And he said that they were offering customers more choice of food, basically. So you, instead of just having to get the free thing that BA gave you, you got more choice of food. Now, I would suggest that actually they should have, maybe if you want to have food, pay for the food. But they should have kept the free drink Because you had more choice of a free drink. And I must admit, okay, I flew with BA recently. We took off an hour late from Heathrow because they needed to de-ice the plane. We were flying to Zurich in winter. Presumably they'd realised before that it was going to be cold. I'm not sure why they didn't de-ice the plane so that it could take off on time. But we took off and I thought, do you know what I'd do if I was BA, or if I was in charge of this plane? All of the passengers know that they're going to be charged for a drink. And this might be the first time they're being charged for a drink. I would say, we're very sorry, everyone. We've taken off an hour late. You can all have a free drink. I mean, yeah, it's going to cost you, like, the money that you'd make off selling them a drink and everything. Mm. But, you know, why not offer them a drink? Because they're going to get off that plane and they're going to say to everyone, do you know what? BA gave us a free drink because we took off late. And everyone would be like, yeah, that's great. BA, good old BA. Still worth flying with them. But they didn't. They just came round, offered us the stuff. It's food from Marks and Spencer's and there's drinks. And I thought, well, at least they might make it a bit cheaper. No, it's not. It's ridiculously expensive. And I looked at it and I just thought, why would I fly BA now over EasyJet? I can't think of any reason why I would fly BA now over EasyJet. There is sort of zero reason. So I think BA is completely lost its competitive advantage.
I love your optimism, though, that passengers on a delayed plane would come off thinking that getting a free drink was okay. No, they would come off and tell their friends, oh, my goodness me, I was on a very long delayed flight. Lee, you were nodding along there.
All right. You know, they're offering M&S food, but most airports have an M&S, so I'd probably just go and buy it for half the price, stick it in my bag and have it when I get on the flight. And, you know, part of the fun of going flying with BA, or was in the past, is seeing how much you could drink into the price of your flight. If you can't do that anymore, then what's the point?
This is Money, in partnership with NS&I. Have any premium bond prizes you win paid directly into your bank account.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio. The team from the finance website of the year, This Is Money, are in the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, and Lee Boyce is here. So we were talking about the banks a little bit earlier, but what about the challengers? Is now their time to step in? Well, we heard from Metro Bank this week too. They're on track to make their first ever annual profit as losses fell 75%. More branches are opening and more fans are coming on board. And we had some cheer for put upon British savers from another challenger bank, Atom Bank, who launched a one-year account paying 2% this week.
This is a relatively new challenger brand. It's doing mortgages, it's planning current accounts in the future, very digitally focused, and they're actually, you know, really pushing hard to be the top of the savings tables. And their strategy there, I would imagine, is two-pronged. Firstly, it's to get money in, whereas the big banks, you know, they don't really need customers' money because they have enough of it. They get enough from the Bank of England via the funding for lending schemes and so on and so forth. But also for challenger brands, being the top of the best buy savings tables, particularly at the moment in the low rate environment, means that they get exposure, they get talked about, that they get people recognising their brand and then choosing to bank with them, so that when they do start to roll out more mortgages, current accounts down the line, people already have that level of familiarity. So if they are looking at their options, they may consider going with them on a more lucrative product.
Well, it's personal finance commentator Hannah Maundrell there. Lee, just a quick one about Metro.
Yep.
It seems customers, fans, should I say, like bricks and mortar after all.
First of all, I'm not going to call them fans. I will just call
them
customers.
Who calls them fans?
Vernon Hill, who is the founder, yes. And I've met up with Craig Donaldson, the chief exec of Metro, a few times, and I like the vision of the bank, and it's good. And they're opening branches in, you know, spots that have got high footfall, and it's starting to, you know, reap rewards now. It's actually become its USP almost, that it's got, you know, branches that open from 8 in the morning till 8 p.m. and people that want that can have it if they're nearby. But of course, a lot of the branches that are disappearing off the high street are in high streets of rural communities. So, you know, it's a bit of a different offering. And to be honest with you, you know, people seem to be quite happy with the way Metro Bank do things and operate, and good for them. You know, costs are going to come down as the years go by because they're opening sort of fewer branches. Branches are really expensive to open. Craig's told me before they cost up to £2 million
and to get out. Massive, yeah. The ones I've seen.
Massive. Yeah,
no,
well, they always get a corner unit and they always have a double-tiered window, that's what I was told, to make it look very clean and bright and whatnot. So obviously it's working for them, and hopefully, you know, it's FTSE 250 listed. I know Vernon Hill has has plans to get on the FTSE 100. And at the moment, you know, things are ticking along quite nicely there. It doesn't really particularly offer attractive deals. Mm-hmm. Its current account was attractive in the first place when it used to let you use it worldwide without any fees. That's just Europe now. But even still, if you're going to Europe, it's still quite handy to be able to take out cash without any sort of withdrawal fee. So it's doing very well.
Okay, so that's good news for Metro. Mm-hmm. Atom Bank.
Now, Atom Bank is it's been a very strange week, George.
This is your story this week, isn't it, Lee?
Yeah, well, this savings rate change, I'll come to in a minute, but earlier in the week, there was rumours circulating that will.i.am is going to be on the board of Atom Bank.
The singer.
And it's going to have a share in the bank. They won't confirm or deny it, but sources have said this is happening.
Just one share.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. Well, no, he can buy shares as the years go on. But I think what it is that it's kind of clever, I suppose, because he's got 14 million Twitter followers. The whole basis of the bank is that it's like tech focused, and will.i.am online has this whole future tech thing going on. I mean, I don't know an awful lot about him, but he's got a big presence online, and it kind of makes sense, and it's attracting those sort of millennials, I guess. I hate the term millennials, but you know, the sort of under 35s that are happy to open a bank account when they finally launch current accounts with a selfie. So the whole thing is, if you want to open a savings account, you have to download the app, so you can only open it on an app. Right, so if you Google Play Store or App Store,
with a selfie.
So if you wanted to open a savings account, you have to get
that
the app.
That put me off right.
And then you have to take a photo. Now it's interesting you say that it put you off right there, Georgie, because I did a bit of digging, and last year in December, interestingly, Atom Bank said that they'd taken £110 million in fixed rate savings since it launched accounts in April.
Mm.
Now £110 million is not an awful lot in the savings world, especially when they were right at top of the Best Buy tables, and they have been for a little while. Now, fast forward to today, and we got an email with some rate changes from Atom Bank, and then we got another email later on in the day saying, actually, no, we're going to offer even better rates than what we were initially going to offer. 2% over 1 year is absolutely incredible. The next Best Buy is 1.6%, and then there's a load of other banks at about 1.35%, so it's way ahead of the market. It's gone absolutely...
And above inflation, importantly.
Yeah, it's gone above inflation, current rate of inflation, for now.
For now, of course.
But, it's not only done that, but it sweats across the whole fixed rate board. So 2 year, it's offering 2.1%. You know, that's better than the 1.75% next nearest. That is it's a big jump.
Mm.
So expert friend of mine, James Blower, he says to me that it sounds like a lot of people are being put off opening savings accounts with that kind of tech method, because a lot of savers and a lot of high net worth individuals are probably going to be over 60, and they're probably not going to be that keen on running and having savings on an app, you know. But
didn't Atom always say from the start that this would be their method? This is who they were targeting.
Totally.
And this generation, the tech savvy generation as well. So they can't be surprised, surely.
I totally get it. But, you know, I just, it's very strange for a bank to go that far above and beyond to top a Best Buy savings table in the current environment. Look, it's great for savers.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, if you're happy to get the app, and it's FSCS protected, you know, which is the most important thing. So you're going to be protected up to the tune of £85,000 now. So, you know, it's just a really funny one. It's been a while since we've had something really, a savings product just come in and just blow the water out of everyone. And just gone, do you know what? We're going to top this by like 0.3%. And it'd be interesting to see in the next couple of weeks if other challengers are going to step up, because, you know, a lot of these challenges are at the Best Buy, top of Best Buy tables, because they need the money to be flowing in. And that's why lots of banks and big building sites at the moment are nowhere to be seen on our savers tables, because they've had funding for lending for a long time and they just don't need savers money. Which is funny, when we were talking about RBS earlier having such big losses, all it has to do is launch a savings account at a fairly decent rate, and it'll probably get that in pretty quickly, I would suggest. What do I know about savings?
Yeah, of course not. I'm going to ask you just really briefly about challenges. Is this the time for them? I know I've asked you this a couple of times in the past, but...
It's really difficult. It's good to have choice, but, it's hard to establish a bank because there's a lot of costs, you know, initial outlay. People, you know, probably do need to give them a chance, and they've got to have the right amount of staff and have the right systems. And look, there's a lot to be said about challenges, and now we're getting into a sort of second wave of challenges. We've had the first wave, you know, ones that sort of set up just after the financial crisis, and they've been ticking along nicely. What we haven't seen much of is challenger banks launching current accounts, and it'd be interesting to see a few more launching current accounts and how they're run and how they're maintained. And look, I still think it's an exciting time for new banks.
Okay, we're going to stick with savings.
I became considerably richer than you through honest hard work. You get what you pay for and you earn what you're worth. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't every financial decision you make a struggle?
So it's not just income inequality. There's a growing savings gap as well. But are the wealthy ever able to understand what it is like for those who cannot save? And therefore, can they commentate on it? Can they make policy on it? Now, Simon, you've been looking at it this week. You've been asking, are you on the right side of the savings divide? You've got a few polls on your article there. Why did you write about this and what are you saying?
Well, we first wrote about this on Monday, which was based on Aviva's Family Finances report. And that looks at households, you know, their money, basically, what they're earning, what their savings are and things like that. And it looked at the difference between the savings and investment pots of low-income families and high-income families. And your savings and investment pot is basically what you've got saved, what you've got invested, and anything you've got in a pension. But it's talking about defined contribution pensions, so where you actually have a pension pot rather than a final salary-style pension. And it said that the gap between the low and high-income families was 62,970. And that basically was because the lower-income families, and apparently 25% of families count as this, have just £95 saved on average. Whereas high-income families, and they account for only 8% of families, so there's not an even, you know, spread there, they had £62,885.
This is savings, investments, does pensions
savings,
count
investments, pensions, yeah, so
right.
Your pension pot
all
as
of it
well.
Together,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I think the problem here, and this excludes your home, okay, excludes the value of your home. I think the problem here is quite often when people get asked this question, they do get a bit confused by that. Well, what actually counts, kind of thing. So we wrote this story and we looked at the background behind it and said, you know, pointed out this great savings divide. And I chucked a poll in there which said, how much do you have in savings and investments? And there was a number of different brackets, and they're not even brackets because I tried to cover a broad spread. But the top one was more than £100,000. And it showed up that our readers have quite a lot of money, basically.
Now, where is that at now? 56?
56% of the people who voted, and there was about 4,800 people have voted in this poll so far. So wow. It's quite a sizable number. Said they have more than £100,000. That's 2,715 votes. But that compares to 3% who said they had under £1,000. Now, that made me think two things. One, I should have set the maximum amount in the poll higher. And two, I wasn't really surprised by this, to be perfectly honest. I know our readers have more money than people on average. They're readers of a financial website. They're going to be likely to have more money. They're engaged. They're financially savvy. You know, I've written enough articles. I've read enough comments. I've spoken to enough readers to know that they skew towards this. And also, if you cast your mind back to the financial crisis, I also remember this, the first time it struck me, actually, was when there was all the concerns about banks collapsing and savings compensation, and the sheer number of our readers who I remember at the time, you know, saying in polls, saying in comments that they had more than the what was a £50,000 savings compensation limit and then went up to £85,000, you know, and their problem of splitting money between banks. But it's, you know, the results of a poll like this, I said, and this is where I pulled in the old Harry Enfield character, are about more than just saying I'm considerably richer than Yao.
Very good, Simon.
It is about sort of highlighting, you know, this divide, because I think that I'm certain that most of our readers who've built up those big savings and investment pots, they have worked very hard for them, okay? And many of them will also probably feel that despite having more than £100,000 in the bank, that they still don't have enough. They will probably be grumbling, many of them grumbling about their lot. And plenty of them will have started from nothing or very little. You know, lots of them won't have gone to grammar school. They won't have gone to public school. Lots of them won't have gone to university. They worked hard, they saved hard, and they did well. But it does highlight, like, how can you possibly understand, as a person who's got the more than £100,000 in the bank and has managed to save that much money, the issues facing someone who struggles to save £100?
Yeah.
I mean, basically, that is an expensive restaurant bill, right? for the people with £100,000. And on the other side of it, it's like if they get to £100 worth of savings, they consider that an achievement. And that's an issue. It's an issue for us journalists, it's an issue for readers, but it's an issue for politicians and people working in the financial industry, because the politicians and the people who work in the financial industry, they skew towards the bit that's got more than £100,000. And the gap is getting wider. And I said that a divided society is no good for all of us. You know, this massive divide that we've got is causing all kinds of problems. But I did another poll as well, where I asked, if you have more than £100,000 in savings and investments, excluding your home, how much do you have? And there the options were £100,000 to £250,000. That came out top with 36%. Mm-hmm. £250,000 to £500,000, which had 26%. £500,000 to a million, 20%. And then 19% of our readers were lucky enough to have more than £1 million in savings and investments, excluding their home. And I bet you loads of those people have got way too much money in cash.
But also, I wonder as well, does this not also tell us age? Surely, if you're older, you're going to have a bigger pension pot. Did we work that out as well? I mean, would you imagine, say, someone who is Lee's age to have the same as someone who's sort of Lee's granddad's age?
No, you wouldn't. And I put in this article that this is by no means a scientific poll. We've asked some people reading a financial website who are more likely to have money and more likely to be older whether they've got money. And unsurprisingly, they said they had money. But it's the amount of money that's surprising. Yeah. Look at that amount of money. But then look at those people who are reading that financial website. It's a financial website that we write for our readers. We address their concerns. And a lot of the policy that gets put in place by the government comes from things that have been identified in the financial press, things that have been lobbied for by the finance industry. You only have to look at things like pensioner bonds and stuff like that. You know, a lot of that stuff is being directed at people who have a vested interest in the people with lots more money. So how can all of those people understand the pressures that are hitting the people who struggle to save £95? And I think that because the gap is what getting wider, this is an issue that we need to really, really think about, rather than just brushing it off with like the casual comment that you will often get on an article of, well, if people worked harder and didn't spend all their money on foreign holidays and flat-screen TVs, they'd be able to save.
That's it, Lee. I mean, whenever we talk about saving, people always say, don't they, everyone can put something aside. Everyone's able to. Well, the reality is actually everybody isn't able to do that.
No, exactly. And we've touched on that quite a few times, George, haven't we? The fact that, you know, everyone's individual circumstances are different and a lot of people are struggling. But perhaps the people that have taken our poll and have, you know, sizable pots of money can tell us how they've done it. Maybe they want to get in touch with Simon, you know, tell their story of, you know, how they've actually secured this money, and give tips to people that are perhaps a bit younger or perhaps, you know, feel like they can't put stuff aside, and maybe there'll be some success stories out there to inspire a new generation of savers and people looking ahead to the future.
That's a good idea. Maybe we should write an article, where did you get all your money from? And then we invite our readers to tell us in the comments where they got all their money from.
And then we send it to the tax man. No, I'm joking. We won't do that.
Ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Right, talking about your readers, you got an email this week from a newly wedded couple. Congratulations to you both. But they're confused about capital gains tax. I imagine, actually, Simon, you get a fair few queries along these lines. But the couple each have their own house, which they want to sell, both of them. They want to buy a new home together. But your reader here was told that married couples can only have one property exempt from the tax. So what was the advice here?
So this is one of the examples, one of the very, very few examples where being married doesn't do you any favours financially. And basically, it's a scenario that crops up for a number of people. So I think that's why it was very well read. And if we're talking about people in lucky financial circumstances, here we have a married couple who have not one but two homes.
Yeah.
But basically, they
but
both
changing families. That's probably quite more common nowadays.
Yeah, it is. But you know, it's a young couple, I think, and they got married. They each own their own home beforehand, and now they want to sell them and buy one home together. So how does that work in terms of tax? Well, everybody is entitled to capital gains tax-free sale of their own home that they live in. So if you've only got one home and you live in it, you can sell it. You don't pay any capital gains tax on the profit. But if you're married, you only get one property. You don't get one each. So because they are now married, if they sell, one of them will have to pay capital gains tax. The other one, they can say it's their principal private residence, they don't have to pay it. But one of them will have to pay capital gains tax. So obviously it would make more sense for the person who's made the least money to sell. But there are a number of reliefs that they can get. And also the good news for them is if they are just freshly married, then there is actually 18 months after you move out of your home where it qualifies for still for capital gains tax free sale. And it sounds like in this instance they will still qualify. So if they'd have waited like 5 or 10 years after getting married, then they wouldn't get that benefit, but if it's within the 18 months then they will do. So that is the answer.
Okay, well, we want to ask you also, because on your website you've gone into more detail about what you need to know about stamp duty on buy-to-let and second homes. So go for it.
What you need to know about stamp duty on buy-to-let and second homes is that, thanks to previous Chancellor George Osborne, you will have to pay a 3% surcharge. The idea was to kind of try to level the playing field a little bit and slow down the buy-to-let market. Now, you might think that's wrong, you might think that's right. There's plenty of people who think it's wrong, there's plenty of people who think it's right. However, the cold, hard reality of it is that at the moment, you have to pay it. And basically, there is pretty much no way of getting around it.
Right.
So the answer is the property you're buying your only home? And if the answer is yes, then you don't pay it. And if the answer is no, it's not my only home, then it is almost certain that you will have to pay the extra 3%. And that includes parents buying a property with their children. It includes someone who already owns a buy-to-let, sells the buy-to-let and buys another buy-to-let. So they're not actually increasing the number of buy-to-lets that they have. What it doesn't include, however, is someone who owns a buy-to-let and lives in their own house and then sells their own house and buys another house for them to live in. That still counts as their house. And so even though they've got this buy-to-let sitting there, they don't pay it. But even if, say, for example, you had a holiday home in France or something and you didn't own a property here, if you bought your first property here, you'd still pay it.
Okay.
So there you go. If you want to find out more, go to thisismoney.co.uk/buy-to-let, where there is a very long article that explains all the different permutations and why you have to pay it.
Yeah, I've asked here, any loopholes, any exemptions? You've just answered that anyway. Right, so I'm going to have a wee break because we've got Lee the Scam Man Boysen, yep, back in the studio. So it would be a good opportunity, Lee, to ask you about the latest one that we've spotted doing the round that I've read this week. Now, scammers hitting those who have a problem with their printer and are contacting a helpline, but you guessed it, it's not genuine. Personal finance expert Rachel Springall has more.
Remote access can be a benefit, but also can be a curse. And this is how they are getting into your machine. So you will go online, you'll have a look to see if you can fix your printer error. Not everybody will do this, but some people do. They advertise a service to remotely log in and fix the error, but they don't. And by then it's too late. They have access to your entire computer and anything you have saved, including passwords. 32,000 last year were affected by this scam. So it's just quite frightening, really, the amount of people that are falling for it.
OK, Lee, how did you come across this one?
I don't know if Lee, the Scam Man Boyce, could be ever a good email sign-off for me. I'm not sure that's
We've
a good
Lee,
nickname
the coin,
to have.
the coin man.
Lee, the Scam Man Boyce, is on the case. It just doesn't sound good.
Oh, well, I'll have a think about it then.
This has been reported by Trading Standards, who've seen their e-crime team have seen a massive rise in this. And in a nutshell, as Rachel just explained, really, if you have problems with your printer, naturally, the first thing a lot of us do when we've got problems with anything in life is use Google and search and see if there's a quick fix. Now, some people will Google certain terms and there'll be unscrupulous firms that have paid for ads on certain search engines. And, you know, we've had all sorts of examples of it in the past, but this one is particularly nasty because you click on it and it's got loads of almost like your certain printer brand is likely to be listed on the website. You're going to think it's kind of genuine. Now, this is very unusual in the way that you actually are contacting the fraudster. Now, usually the scam is that you're getting an email that's come from a fraudster or you're getting a phone call, but because you're making the phone call, you're probably less likely to think it's a scam. I had a little search actually online and I found some very unscrupulous looking websites for this.
You know,
just Googling things like
highlights,
you know,
for you.
Printer broken, not working, or how do I fix my printer? And they were just coming up to the top of Google ads, and maybe some of them were genuine, but they looked really quite spivvy. And I'm probably going to do a little bit more digging and find out. But, you know, you phone up, You think you're speaking to someone, and then they'll ask for remote access, and that's game over. They're either going to blackmail you and say, if you want us to unlock this now, you know, you pay us a few hundred quid, which is quite a common one, or they'll start having to fiddle around, having a look at your personal files, look for addresses, bank account details, all that sort of thing. So it's just yet another scam that you just need to keep your eye on. And, you know, if you do have a printer problem, you know, make sure you do contact your actual manufacturer, or, you know, there's just better ways than looking at a sponsored ad online.
That's horrible, isn't it?
It is. I hate scams. Yeah.
I won't call you scam man.
Because it's like, a lot of people go, you know, especially people commenting the story, go, how do you fall for this, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of people will fall for it because,
yeah,
I think I would. Yeah, you know.
I'm rubbish with tech.
And a lot of people are trusting, and they think, you know, you're going to phone up and get the printer fixed. You know, you need remote access. And a lot of people maybe aren't as tech savvy as others. So, you know, it's just good to put these warnings out there and alert people.
All right, then. Well, we'll move on from that. Time to take a spin. And I want to talk about the foreign love affair with British cars. Now, that seems as strong as ever. Production at a 9-year high, despite Brexit gloom and doom. Most of the cars, though, being sent overseas. Why are we here spurning homegrown for foreign imports, Simon?
I don't know. I don't really know.
All right,
I think
then.
So. You can't just put it down to the fact that we make luxury vehicles. Okay, we've got some very famous luxury vehicle manufacturers. Jaguar Land Rover at the more sort of mainstream end of that, through to Aston Martin at the other end, Bentley, Rolls Royce, so on and so on. But it's not just because we only make luxury vehicles, because also Minis, we make a lot of those, and you certainly see a lot of those. We buy a lot of those as well. But Toyota, Honda, Vauxhall, you know, those are all mainstream cars, and we do buy quite a lot of them. You see a lot of them on the road. We've ramped up production, and a lot of them go overseas. But maybe it's a sign of the success of our car industry in terms of making something that people want to buy and making it very well, which means that basically a lot of those cars are being exported overseas. And also maybe it's a slight reflection on the fact that I think in terms of the I'll buy a British car thing, I think we lost that many, many years ago, and I don't think it's ever come back. I think the reputation that we got for not particularly well-built cars in the 70s and 80s basically killed off the I will buy a British car thing, and we've never managed to revive that. I think certainly if you look at the luxury sector, you might still get that. You know, I'll buy a Jaguar, I'll buy an Aston, or I'll buy a Rolls-Royce, but I don't think you get that, you know, further down the scale.
All right, well, I do want to talk about luxury, but not British. Ferrari, topic of cars. We've seen an interesting addition to Ferrari's range this week. But your motoring correspondent, Rob, I believe it is, he's not happy at the name.
No, he's not sold on the name, to be perfectly honest. And, I mean, I'll tell you why he's not sold on the name. You know when you're overseas, you're on holiday, and you go past a shop and you see a T-shirt for sale, and it's basically, it either says something completely stupid, or it's taken two words that have no relationship and put them together. You know, like, oh, I can't think of anything.
Right.
Mega chair or something, or skate mega or
Where
something
do you
like
go
that.
On holiday? You know,
it's
right,
just,
yeah, yeah.
He's completely daft, or it says something completely childish. Well, Ferrari has called its new car the 812 Superfast.
Right, that's what it says on
Rob
the tin.
Says it sounds
the
812 like...
part though.
That's just the kind of model number.
All right.
8 12 cylinders, super fast. I think that, you know, Rob is basically pointing out that this sounds like it was named by a primary school child.
Yeah, it's all right. It's not a brilliant.
You know
name.
What next? The Mega Quick.
It made me think that Ferrari.
Don't even joke, Simon.
That Ferrari were bringing out broadband. That's what I thought. Super fast. Yeah. I mean, that was the first thing I thought of. Yeah.
The difference is they actually go fast.
Yeah, that is true. That's a good point, Georgie. That's a valid point. Yeah.
Thank you very much. If you do want the super fast Ferrari, I'm sure it drives perfectly well. What does it matter what it's called? You'll probably need to save up in a good place to start. I'm not kidding. Maybe your pocket, your piggy bank, or the back of the sofa. I can't believe there is another story about how much your coinage could really be worth. But this time, Lee, it is £2 coin, and you've been receiving emails from readers.
Georgie, I'm just giving the public what they want. And, you know, I'm getting emails. I'm getting up to 50 emails a day people asking about their coins, asking if their coins are valuable, with a real lovely selection of photographs that I get sent of coins, which, you know, absolutely fantastic. Coins. Yeah, yeah, coins.
Please
yeah.
tell me you sign off Lee, the coin man voice on
well,
that one, though.
I should do, shouldn't I? Maybe I should start adopting that and taking that as my slogan. But one of these coins that kept on popping up, it's a £2 coin that was launched in 2014 to commemorate 100 years since the start of First World War. And it's the famous poster of Lord Kitchener where he's saying, "Your country needs you," yep. pointy finger. Right. Now, we're getting this loads, letters, emails, you know, is this worth more than £2? Yeah. And the answer is no. And I've gone a long way about it in this article, you know, explaining £2 coins. Yeah. But there's actually 5.7 million of them that were minted. So it's not rare at all. So the likelihood is it's not worth more than £2. The only way it could be worth more than £2 is if it's got a minting error. And that's the same for any coin. If a coin has a minting error, it makes it a little bit rarer and collectors are more interested. So I did a bit of digging to look at £2 coins and to see if any of them are, you know, sort of rare. And I did. I found the rarest £2 coin. It's yeah. actually one commemorating the Commonwealth Games from 2002. There was four of these different coins made, like four different designs, each with a different flag of the home nation. So Northern Ireland, Wales, Scotland, England. Now, the one that's got 485,500 is the one with the Northern Irish flag. And they do. They sell for sort of up to £30 Ooh. Online. So if you get one of those, actually, they are far rarer than these Lord Kitchener ones.
It's not going to get you a Ferrari, but
it's not going to get you a Ferrari. But just also to put that into context, the one that's really famous, the coin that kind of, you know, people really do seem to know about, is the Kew Gardens 50p, where it was revealed a couple of years ago that only 210,000 of those were minted, and they can sell for up to £50 online. So it shows you that even though the rarest £2 coin is still nowhere near as scarce as the 50p. But I know we joke around about coins, but some of it, yeah, it's interesting. People seem to really be getting into collecting coins and checking their change, and you may come and hit a win. I think it's always that nice thought of actually getting a coin that might be worth something.
Do you not feel a little bit responsible, though, for all this madness, Lee? All this madness.
It's no madness. Yeah. I'm just, you know, as I said, I'm just giving the public what they want, Georgie. Yeah. I'm not ramping anything
You're making
up.
Them want that.
I'm not ramping it up. I'm just giving. I'm just stating facts, and I'm just letting you know
Simon.
What we're seeing.
Before we finish, I just think that Lee should tell us about the coin that's got the Queen with a beard on.
All right, okay. So this was brilliant. The other day we sat down, Simon. We do our sort of like, you know, daily news list and what we're writing about. And I said I was writing this story about a £2 coin. And then Simon started joking and saying, "Oh, I've got a coin, and the Queen's got a moustache on it." Now that very morning, Simon was obviously joking around. That very morning, I had actually received an email from a reader who has sent in a £2 coin with the Queen, in which he said the Queen had a beard. And he sent me real close-ups of this coin, and there is a very slight little error, and she's got a little beard. And it was just so funny because Simon's talking about this coin. And I'm like, "You joke, Simon, but I have had a beardy Queen coin this morning, and it's real."
You really do get them all. Consumer Affairs Editor Lee, the Coin Man Boyce, and Editor Simon Lambert.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.
You've been listening to This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. If you enjoy listening to the show, we'd like to hear more about some of the topics you're interested in our survey. It takes less than 5 minutes to complete, and you could be in with a chance of winning a brand new digital radio. Just go to our Facebook or Twitter page for details.